Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I am your host, Jeff Howard, and today's interview is going to be with Patrick Connolly. Patrick made a short film called The Creeping Ritual, which from the first time I saw it to, I don't know, maybe the fifth time I've seen it, always amazes me with its originality, its creativity, and just when people look at it, some of them think it's out there, but actually, it's like laser focused. And I am happy to say it's the kind of film that I'm really proud to include in our festivals. It screened at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival last year, 2018, and Iron Lion. I would love to get everyone I know to sit down and watch this film. And by the way, do you want to watch it? You should watch it before you listen to this interview. And you can do that if you go to discoveryindiefilm.com on Amazon Prime. That's right, the podcast has a companion TV series, or I guess you could say the TV series has a companion podcast. I don't really care which side you favor, but you should watch this film. It's actually in episode 9 of season 2, and season 2 hits October 1st. And if you want to see it sooner than that, just go to discoveryindiefilm.com and go to the page for Patrick's interview and The Creeping Ritual. And there will be a way to see The Creeping Ritual right there. I swear it. Just realizing it's hard for me to say The Creeping Ritual without muffling my words. But anyway, after the podcast, I'll tell you about film festivals and social media and all kinds of other things. But I've already said enough. Let's listen to my interview with Patrick.
I went to film school in 2005 and 2006. I went to 4 semesters at Emerson College after going to the year night school to write where I went to screenwriting, and then I went to community college for 2 years. But I always loved film as a kid. And
yeah, because you studied screenwriting and then you did that, but obviously you were really into it to take the screenwriting class.
Yes, I wanted to write. I got really interested in wanting to like be a screenwriter after I watched Pulp Fiction when I was about 15, 16. And I always liked film anyway. I remember one of my earliest memories was seeing Back to the Future at the movie theater when it came out. I was born in 1981, so it came out in 1985. And I saw it at the movie theater. I remember seeing it at the movie theater and being like deeply affected by it. And then I was like all those Robert Zemeckis and Tim Burton films I really liked. And then,
right. So you were a kid who got into, you knew the director was key and you would like follow a director, like you would start renting a bunch of Zemeckis or a bunch of Burton.
No, I just remember seeing their names and liking all their movies. Like I knew Tim Burton did Beetlejuice. I saw that in the movie theater when it came out and it fucking blew my mind. And then I knew he did the next Batman. I saw that when that came out and I thought that was amazing. And then Tim Burton again did Batman Returns. No, actually, the first director I ever knew who he was and made a specific style of films, which were all totally different, was Oliver Stone. So I liked all those films growing up as a kid. And then when I was about Tim Burton, Pee Wee's Big Adventure. That was my favorite.
That was his first.
Yeah, that was so good. Yeah, I have. I was like obsessed with that when I was 6 or 7. And then I started getting stoned when I was 13, 14 and happened upon it again because it was on cable. And I was like, this movie's brilliant. You know, and this is when I was 13, 14. And I started studying screenwriting when I was 19, 20. And I saw it again, and I'm like, this movie's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
My whole life, I saw it in a different way, and it met the standards each time.
Yeah, right. As a kid, Pee-wee's Big Adventure is super entertaining.
It's just entertaining.
And then as a teenager,
this is weird.
Because it's a kid. I mean, the character Pee-wee, I can get really into this topic, by the way. Yeah. Because I'm old enough, Pee-wee was a, you know, he developed Pee-wee at the Groundlings, It was really kind of dirty and kind of X-rated what he did with him. And then he kind of like, they cleaned it up for film, but kept this edge to it.
Yeah. It's just odd edge.
It's a really sophisticated, and the fact that they hired Tim Burton for that, I think
He was a kid. Yeah, he was a kid when he did that. He was in his late 20s.
Yeah, he just sent this short, actually, I had seen his short Vincent. There's those animation celebration tours. So Vincent was this rad thing. And then the fact that he got hired. So cool.
And then he delivered, too. He totally delivered. Yeah, no, the character's very sophisticated and very funny. And but he's like sexually ambiguous, so like asexual. It's so funny. And he
yeah, he's a sex symbol to Dottie. Like Dottie's so no, I know, into but
he
does.
You know, he's also a sex symbol to Mickey, the convict that he's driving in the car. He's a sex symbol to everybody, and he just has like this really weird childlike fucking mentality. And
there's just such a sophistication to
there is. Know. There's a lot to that film, and it's most of it. And I didn't realize this until I started studying film. It's directly taken from The Bicycle Thief from 1947, the Italian neorealism film.
That makes sense.
Actually, shots that are taken.
Because Phil Hartman and Paul Rubens wrote
that,
right?
They wrote it, yeah. Yeah, but like when he gets his bike stolen and he's watching all the people go by on their bikes, it's straight out of The Bicycle Thief. And I didn't realize that until I was like 23. So I'm still watching this movie and I'm still picking up stuff that's just so fucking genius. And then he like saves all the animals at a. It's very symbolic. He saves them all at a pet store.
Yeah,
it's so good. But anyway, stuff like that is like made me really.
And you said Pulp Fiction made you really want to write.
Yeah. So when I was whatever, I don't know if I was like sad or depressed or I wanted to like escape when I was a kid. But I remember I used to watch that movie all the time, and that would do. It would have a different effect on me every time I saw it, and I would see something new in it every time I saw it. And then, like, I got past all the violence and all that sensational stuff, like, really fast. And then I started realizing, like, what a screenwriter did. And I'm like, oh, my God. And then I was like, I talk like these people. I know people like this. Not like, the fake stuff, but the people who hang out and talk. Like, I hang out with people like that, you know? And like, some of the dialogue in it was just so funny when they get angry and they start yelling at each other. It was just so funny.
Yeah, and his writing is so literary, you know? It's so... It's funny because, a lot of people think of Pulp Fiction for the shock value or this.
Yeah.
But no, it's very poetic.
It is, yeah. The way they talk is poetic. The stuff they talk about
and the story structure and the way he weaves the stories together is really. I mean, obviously, that influenced a ton of people.
Yeah, it influenced every. I feel like, a lot of it influenced a lot of people, and I don't want to say the wrong way, but it influenced me differently, I feel like, than it influenced a lot of other people who were more attracted to the violence.
A lot of people, yeah, well, you know. And I can't tell you how many indie films I saw with a standoff with guns.
Yeah, with the
you know, everyone's like, brain splatter. You gotta have that moment where there's four people all pointing guns at each other. Yeah,
but there's like a moment where he's laying in bed. Bruce Willis comes in from the fight, and he's laying in bed with his wife, with his girlfriend. That's one of the best scenes in the movie. That's like one of the most mature scenes that guy's ever written. It's so fucking good. It's so dead on.
And this boxer is suddenly almost like he's so innocent with her.
Yeah.
And she has so much power over him. You know, like with the slightest disapproval in her voice, he backs off, you know?
Yeah. I know. And he makes her cry when he talks. And then he gets really remorseful. It's so good.
It really is. And him driving away when he's driving away to get, and he's like, one thing I taught you to get was like that moment in the car. So actually, I'm connecting that with your film, The Creeping Ritual, like a little.
Yeah, I brought that to a screenwriting group, and I got, and someone was like, "Oh, this is like a Quentin Tarantino script." I'm like, "Really?"
I was going to think it was Tarantino.
It was the opening scene when the guy and girl were talking. Someone was like, "Oh, this reminds me of what Quentin Tarantino would write." I'm like, "Wow, thank you."
Yeah, you know? I mean, I don't see it as derivative. But I can see the slight inspiration of, you know, the person driving and like. You know, just like cursing a little bit of the conversation they just had.
Which
is not derivative at all. It's just like...
I think it's totally... A lot of it... Well, yeah, that's nice of you to say thank you. I felt it was totally derivative.
Oh, well, I don't.
I'm proud to do that.
Tarantino's never had the balls to talk about God. But besides that...
Yeah.
We're still talking about when you were...
So that was when I was 17 years... Yeah, I was about 17 years old and I started writing my first screenplay. And I would go home at night. I used to like drink too much and get screwed up too much when I was a kid. But I'd go home and I would write, and I was working on the screenplay. And I wrote a whole screenplay when I was 17 years old, and nothing ever came of it. And then I started writing another one right after that when I was 18 years old. And it was like all on my own. And I used to like tell people I was going to be a screenwriter, but I was like a total idiot. As a kid, and I was an idiot as a kid. And then I went to a community college and kept trying to write. And then,
And you were just writing by instinct. You didn't pick up a book or anything.
No, I never read a book till I was 20 years old. And it wasn't cause I was illiterate. Cause I was like fully full blown ignorant. I just would never read books. I just watched movies. I read Entertainment Weekly, but I watched movies and did stuff, but I would never read books. I would never get into like trying to learn anything. And other than I had the script to Pulp Fiction, and I used to copy that too. I learned how to like format a script by reading that.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
Yeah, and then so I was doing Entertainment Weekly. I had that magazine, and then they had what's it called? An advertisement for Robert McKee's Story Seminar.
Yeah,
which I went to in 2002, the year before. Or it was about 6 months before Adaptation came out. I went to that, and that changed everything about me wanting to be a screenwriter. And I actually learned like how serious it was, and like what you can do with it.
Yeah.
And then started to like really like. Well, it actually kind of scared me away from it because it took a lot to be a screenwriter, is what he was saying. You know, and it kind of like it was daunting for a little while. And then I saw the movie Adaptation came out. I went in May of 2002, and in December of 2002, I think Adaptation came out, and I thought that movie was wonderful too. And then I went into the Robert McKee screenwriting seminar the following year, and this was that was my introduction to like formal screenwriting teaching. And then I cleaned up my act when I was 21. And then I moved back in with Ma and Dad. And my father my whole life had been trying to get me to stop getting all screwed up. And he would offer me, like, education and trips and all that stuff. And I never accepted any of it. And as soon as I cleaned up my act, I asked if he could send me to the night school at Emerson College so I could take a screenwriting course. And he said yes. So I went. I took six courses at night over the first year, 2003. And I took a screenwriting course, and I wrote my first screenplay. 75 pages of it, didn't finish the third act. And that led to, I went to two semesters of night school, took a semester off, and then I went to four semesters of day school and film school and studied film, mostly for screenwriting and directing. And I graduated from there in 2006. And in 2007, I was going to make a feature-length independent film that I was going to write, produce, direct, edit, all that stuff. And it fell apart in the summer of 2007. And then I didn't have anything to do with anything film or cinema on my own from 2007 to 2018.
Right, so for 11 years you just focused on work? Or
I worked and wrote novels.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So
you didn't turn your back on creativity at all?
Didn't turn my back on creativity. I turned my back on film. And it was it was devastating.
Because it does take so much to get a feature together. So much.
It does. Not at all.
The fact that it didn't come together is not a knock on you at all, because so much has to go right for a feature to come together.
Yeah. That's nice of you to say. Thank you.
Unless you tell me I was just going to shoot like something like Clerks.
I'm going to go to a fucking 3-day music festival, and I was going to like bring all these people and film them Altman, Nashville. I was 25 years old. I had the whole thing written. I was going to do that, and people were like on board and stuff.
Yeah, so you were ambitious.
Very, very ambitious. Yeah. And it just kind of fell apart.
Then you realize, hey, I can write a novel, and I don't have to count on anyone but myself.
I was so disheveled. I was just like totally defeated by the whole thing. And then I started reading George Orwell, and I'm like, oh, I can write like this. And then I started, you know, working on a novel, and I wrote a full novel manuscript, which also never got published. But I wrote
publishing. It's a very rough world for publishing.
I wrote a novel manuscript, and that lasted 2007 to 2015, the first one. And then I started writing a second one, and then we moved to LA, and then I started going to movies and movie theaters where the filmmakers were, and got inspired to make films again.
Was there a film that it really clicked?
There was, Brother from Another Planet, John Sayles.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, so John Sayles. Ernest Dickerson was Dickerson was there, and their producer was there, and they did one of the best Q&As I've ever been to. And that movie blew my fucking mind. Yeah, that's where a lot of my film comes from. That's like where a lot of the inspiration comes from, was from Brother from Another Planet.
And the reason I have this unbelievable smile on my face is I saw Brother from Another Planet on my first date ever when I was 16, when it came out in 1984.
And
it completely changed my life. That film is the reason I went into film.
Really? Yeah. No shit.
It's not like people have heard of John Sayles. More people have heard of him than watch his stuff.
Yeah.
Because he's just kind of known as he's just an offbeat indie guy.
He's an offbeat dude. Yeah.
And he's the guy that like wrote the movie Coma in a weekend, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, he's an auteur. He's fantastic, and that film is so special.
It is. It was absolutely. It was like mind boggling, and it was. I'd never seen anything like it. I still haven't. Nobody's ever made anything like it.
Yeah, it's such a voice. Like it, that film. Yeah. That film was the first film I ever saw, where I said, you know, because unlike Spielberg, like you know, Spielberg, this that, fine, they have a voice, but like Brother from Another Planet, I was like, wow, this is like someone's. Personal,
it was fucking. It was
voice.
So personal, and it was so like nobody could. No one. It was like untampered with the voice.
Exactly.
And nobody was like allowed to be like, oh, this doesn't work, and that doesn't work. He comes. I'm gonna give a. It's kind of like a spoiler, but it's not. But the alien comes upon somebody who's overdosed on heroin, and he touches him, and I'm watching it, and I'm like, oh, he's gonna bring him back. Like a shot of Narcan. It's like, no, he actually takes the needle and he shoots it in himself and tries it himself.
Yeah.
And I'm like, can you even do that? You allow it? I've never seen, like, where does that, that is so, like, far out, and that's such, like, that's the end result of, like, so many different choices and so many different ideas and so many different decisions that they came to that decision at the final. I know that they, like, thought up and tried so many other things, and, like, that was the absolute farthest out, most right thing to do that would keep in line with what they were making. Yeah. It was just so fucking bizarre. I'd never seen anything like that. It wasn't supposed to be like that. That was just too off mainstream, off something to,
absolutely,
to be shown.
Because it was the brother experiencing our culture.
It was all about
planet.
Experiencing,
and
I realized,
was
yes.
He not gonna? It totally made sense.
Exactly, because he was a benevolent, like a benevolent
ET. But
if there
had been any, I'll just use the word studio executive, but if there had been any supervision at all,
they would have like,
said,
oh, no, you can't do that. He's got to save him.
Yeah,
they got to say,
that.
Yeah, you got to drop it. He's got to save him.
He can fix video games, but he's not going to save a person.
He's a little too dark. It's a little too dark for that, they would say, you know?
It's funny because I'm so messed up. I didn't even see. It is dark. It's really dark.
Yeah, but it's also very funny and very strange. It's just, it's a very, very personal, individualistic film. It's so good.
Yeah.
And so on top of all that, they were there. John Sayles was there, and he was talking about the making of it. Well, he's just he seems like a phenomenal dude. I didn't meet him personally, but listening to him, we listened to him for like, he did like 2 hours, maybe an hour.
Is that
and
at
half.
The New Beverly or something?
This
like
is
that?
At the Cine Family before it shut down. Oh, back in 2016 or 2017. It was before they shut down. It was part of they had a 80s indie films from the 80s, whatever it's called, series.
By the way, props to you for being the kind of person to go to that.
Oh, I have to. That's all I go to. I don't go to multiplexes or any of that stuff. Yeah. Cinefamily's gone, but I only go to the New Beverly. Tonight, I'm going to the UCLA Billy Wilder Theater to see Miracle Mile with Anthony Edwards. I go to to the New Beverly, the Egyptian, Arrow, and what was the other one I go to?
Yeah, the Arrow's cool now. Because the Arrow was bought out by...
They're with the Egyptian.
Yeah, the same people on the Egyptian.
Yeah, American Cinematheque. Yeah, who apparently was taken over. Is going to be taken over by Netflix.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I hope that's okay.
I don't know. Apparently, some people like it. Some people are horrified, but I don't know. Whatever. But anyway, I go. Yeah, those are the only places I go to, and I only go see like. Oh, in LACMA on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. They show like a matinee, like old films. That's all I go to.
Excellent.
And But,
so cool. So you go to this Brother from Another Planet screening, and you're like, fuck it, I'm going to make a film again.
No, I was like, because John Sayles was like, we didn't have any money, didn't have any permits, didn't know what we were doing. Ernest Dickerson, who shot Spike Lee's films and ended up directing Juice, ended up working on The Wire. Fresh out of NYU, worked on the film for nothing, deferred pay, all that stuff. They just made a film. And I was like, oh my God, I can do that. You know, because in 2007, I'm like, oh, you can't do it. You tried, you failed, you're a loser. It's not, you know, you have to be something or be something else in order to do what you think you want to do. But when I was listening to this guy talk, and after just seeing what I saw, I'm like, I can so do that. And I'm not saying I can, like, do anything better than what he did. I'm like, I just knew it who he was talking about, and I could do it. And part of that same series, I saw a film called Suburbia, with which was made by Penelope Spheeris, who made the decline of Western. Yeah, she made the decline of Western civilization. Yeah. She was 38 years old.
She did the docs, but then Suburbia was her first narrative film.
Right? Yes, and she did after doing the documentary because she was 38 years old and she heard the Germs. She heard some punk rock band. She was fucking 38 years old and she's like, oh my god, I finally found my people. She grew up in the 60s and the 70s with hippies and disco and stuff, and obviously just didn't like it. And then she was my well, I'm 37 now, and she's my age listening to kids 20 years younger than her. Who are actually speaking her language, and she like sought them out and started making these really low budget, odd, indie kind of documentaries, and then a narrative film. And so she was another one who I was very, very inspired by. And then that's how I kind of got.
So that inspired you to jump back in.
That inspired me to jump back in. Yes, and I was doing an artist way group with a couple other guys, and we were all going to work on it together, but they, for whatever reason, you know, various different reasons, people dropped out, but I just kind of got it in my head that I was going to keep going, and I did, you know.
So you just sat down and started writing and...
Yeah, I don't even know how...
Planning it out?
Started writing. I didn't start planning it out. I just started writing because the movie, you know, I don't know if... I'm assuming anybody listening to this has not seen the film, so I guess I'll talk about the film as like somebody who's obsessed with juice and you've heard
an intro to the podcast. I always say you got to watch the film.
If you haven't seen the film, it's about a dude who's kind of who's obsessed with, you know, coconut water and sex and yoga.
Yeah, I think you referred to him as a Hollywood douchebag.
I've actually changed that.
Which I defend
line.
Him. I defend him, yeah, because I'm like, wait, he's not a douchebag. I kind of identify with him. I mean, he really just wants his refreshing drink before yoga. That's all he really wants.
That was inspired by living in Los Angeles. Yeah, a lot of that stuff just came to me. It was nothing, I didn't even have to think of, I don't know.
Did you plan to write a short, or you just started writing?
Plan to write a short, yeah. Right. Yeah, I wanted to write a short, and I wanted to write it with a female character, and I wanted to write it with a dude who was just totally fucked up, like a totally whacked out L.A. dude I've seen. Because there's like, we've been in L.A. for 4 years, and I tell people this who aren't from here, don't come here, I'm like, they think that there's like all these stereotypes about Los Angeles, but no one ever mentions the fact that there's like... 4-point-something million people in Los Angeles and 9-point-something million in L.A. County. So you really can't make a fucking stereotype when you have 9 million people. It's like saying something about the people in India. You just can't. It's really difficult to do. But I will say some of the nicest people I've ever met, I've met in Los Angeles, and some of the biggest fucking assholes I've ever come across in my life have been in Los Angeles and everybody in between. So I've come across that stereotype of the person who's like not very nice to be around, and I wanted to make a film about them because not only had I heard about those people before I got here, but I met people like that, and I'm like, where do they get off acting like that? Not that I haven't acted like that, but I'm like, where does that come from? And on top of that, a lot of the people who are into health and wellness and stuff act like that. And I'm like, wow, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, it is interesting that there's the assumption that they're a little hippy-dippy because they're into, you know, he cares about the chemicals in the bottle cap.
Which is neurosis.
But you'd think if you were really into the health scene.
Yes.
Eating healthy, that you would be into like the spiritual side of being kind to people too.
This is a whole,
but not true. Not true.
It's not true because
I try to tell all the kids in my family. I'm like, you know, because whatever, we got Republicans and we got Democrats, we got everyone in between. I'm like, there's assholes and nice people everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. Nothing guarantees you avoiding assholes.
And I've noticed that a lot of the people who, and this isn't this isn't a negative statement. I'm glad that people try to improve their lives as opposed to self-destructing. But there's a lot of people who are in the health and wellness, whatever you want to call it, fall under that umbrella that go there because of neurosis. And I'll just stop it. Stop at that. And that's what this was kind of.
Yeah, I know. They're seeking.
Everybody's seeking.
Holes in here. And they think they can fill it with bullshit.
Yeah. So you wouldn't be doing that if there wasn't something that's pushing you to do it, you know? So that kind of interested me. And actually, yeah, I met a guy like that who was so nice to me when I first met him. He's like, oh, if you need anything, just give me a call. Because I was new to town and he was from back east or whatever. And I was like, wow, this guy's such a nice guy. And then I called him a couple of days later and he's like, can I help you? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I met you the other day, and he was just like, he was like a totally opposite person. And I realized this is what that character was inspired by. He was not phony, and he was not being phony in either of his fucking personalities that I came across. He was totally insane. The man was totally insane, but he was successful, and he had nice sneakers and drove a nice car and was working on whatever, television or something like that. But the dude was fucking nuts.
So just a little schizo. These sides were completely unrelated.
Yeah, I caught him on a good day, and then I caught him on a bad day. And he wasn't being phony when he was being nice to me, and he wasn't being phony when he was being mean to me. That's just the way this dude is. And I'm like, wow, that's fucking fascinating to me. And then I'm like, how does somebody get away with that? That's so interesting to me, you know?
Yeah, when they go to sleep at night, how do they not think over their day and go, why did I do that?
Yeah, maybe I should slow down or try, you know, and then they are trying
stuff. I'm already wondering if he's like, if there's drugs involved.
Yeah, there was no drugs involved, no alcohol involved. Nope. He was just a whacked out dude. He was a crazy dude. And I just found it absolutely fascinating. He fell into that latter half of people I talk about that I've met in Los Angeles. Just a very unpleasant person to be around, but it was very, I don't know. It just fascinated me. So that was like the idea for that character came from. Right.
So the Matt, yeah. So your Matt character was inspired by this guy.
Yeah, in that type.
Or the idea to write about that.
Yeah, the idea to write about that, because it just interested me that people can be one way and be another way. Yeah. Which is like, you can be going to yoga, but you can be a total asshole.
How long did you work on the script? Like,
Probably started writing it in, when did we shoot it? We shot it in 2018. So maybe May or summer of 2017, I started writing the ideas and writing, like mapping it out. And then writing scenes, and then by November 2017, I think it was done. So I spent several months on it, wrote draft after draft.
And you started with that asshole idea, or character, or unpleasant person to be around idea. Like, when did the other themes come in? Because, I mean, for a 18-minute short, I mean, you cover a lot of ground.
So, yeah, I had brought that up about, the other themes that came in, the other theme was like, a lot of that stuff is in the movie is totally unoriginal. Like, I'm a big Ingmar Bergman fan. Mm-hmm. And so The Seventh Seal, it's such an obvious reference, but the lead character is followed around by Death wearing a cloak. And I just fucking ripped that off. Yeah. And I made a film about a dude who's followed around by a dude wearing a green graduation gown.
Right, right.
You know? And that, I forget if that what came first, my Ingmar.
But I thought he was like is he one of God's angels, or is he Satan, or is he?
Yeah, he's Lucifer.
He's
yeah,
Satan. Yeah.
Just as the the Seventh Seal, the dude in the black is he's Death.
Yeah.
You know, and I forget if I got that idea before or after reading Carl Jung. I was going through Carl Jung, and he talks about he covers a lot of ground himself, but one of his subjects is the idea of the shadow self.
I'm totally ignorant on Jungian stuff.
Okay, all right.
So you got to educate me.
I know. I can't educate on him quite as right now, but I know. So there was two schools of thought a long time ago, and some psychology major out there is going to tell me I'm wrong. So there was Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung.
Freudian and Jung. Carl Jung
Had leaned towards spirituality and the proof and existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And like he... when he had this long essay, treatise, whatever you want to call it, about the human being constantly in battle with a shadow self,
mm-hmm.
which is basically like a voice of self-destruction right. that follows everybody everywhere and just fucking yaps at your ear all the time. And I think, and I want to say from what I read from it, is that you're going to be telling that the only way to kind of combat this voice is to believe in God. You know, or like some sort of belief in a higher power. I'll just keep it as
whereas Freud was in the world of it's just your demons and what you were raised.
Just your demons and your sex and your mother and whatever.
Yeah. It's all nurture.
It's all nurture. Jung was like not the opposite of it, but he was into
He's
God.
Like, yeah, our nature. Yeah, and God's our nature. Sure.
Yes, and if you believe in God, it can overcome all this stuff type of thing. Or, you know, if you don't believe in God, you might succumb to the self-destructive voice, all that. And then I forget why, and somewhere in there I referred to the Book of Job in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
where Lucifer, who got thrown out, gets cast out of heaven, comes back to heaven, and tells God that his whatever, believer, follower named Job doesn't really believe.
Right, he's faking it.
He's kind of faking
it.
Yeah,
like, prove to me.
He's as pious as you think he is and he says he is, you know? So that so God just threw all these calamities at him.
I know. Everyone refers to that as, like, you know, the Old Testament God is such a motherfucker.
Oh, yeah, just straight punishment. It's all punishment and ego. Yeah. God had the ego and everything. God was not a benevolent God. Wasn't a loving God. It was all about fucking punishment and ego and do as I say, not as I do. So at the end of the book of Job, I'll paraphrase here, says, you know, that this the term, God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
Jesus said that, but Job says something about, like, why are you doing this to me?
Yeah, at some point he's pushed to his limit.
Yes, when he's pushed to his limit, his faith is actually tested. He says, why are you doing this to me? And God said, it's really not your place to ask. You just better keep believing and keep doing what you're doing, you know? And it's also an allegory.
A bunch of people hanging out in the desert. I mean, it makes sense to have stories like this.
Yeah.
I'm a very anthropological view. I grew up Jewish, and I kind of look at things anthropologically. Like, of course, these are the stories you told around the campfire.
Yes. And it's also an allegory for why does good stuff happen, why does bad stuff happen to good people.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to say, why does this happen? It's like, don't question me. Don't give up faith. Don't question me. Keep going.
You can't get an answer. Like, why have I had a shitty run?
Exactly. That's what this whole, book of Job was about in my eyes, is that you're not getting a fucking answer. If bad stuff happens, all you can do is just keep hoping, keep praying, and maybe.
Yeah, it's like a really good meme with a cat hanging from a tree saying, you know, hang in there.
Yeah, yes, yes.
A little bit.
And, so that's where that came from, the book of Job. And then my brother passed away from a drug overdose in 2016. And I also referred to, like, that experience. There was actually when I first wrote the script, the cut we have now, I just put all these, like, random shots around LA, which I think is totally cool, with cool music over
it. With the sort of, like, your credit sequence?
Sequence at the beginning.
Opening titles,
credit sequence, yes.
I know, I dig it. You know, a lot of people don't do that anymore. And watching your film, I'm like, you know what? I dig that this is, like, he's starting it like a movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It starts like a movie.
I like that when I see it. Yeah. I like To Live and Die in LA and Colors and fucking so many other movies that you'll show you, like, a flash of Los Angeles or a flash of New York, and then you'll get a title sequence and then a flash of whatever city you're in, or the Jim Jarmusch film in New Orleans. I like that, you know, but originally it wasn't going to be flashes of the city. It was going to be, like, you know, the assembly line at a slaughterhouse, a person really overdosed in drugs, homeless camp, all this, like, really dark, you know, that BP oil spill. Is going to be all this crazy shit, and I just didn't do it. But one of them was going to be a person dead in their bathroom from a drug overdose. But my brother passed away from a drug overdose, and before he had passed away, he had been found dead, for lack of a better term. And I had asked him, and he was brought back, and I asked him why, if he was trying to harm himself, and he said he wasn't. He just wanted to escape, and he said he would never hurt himself. He just needed to escape. So that kind of played into the idea of this shadow self, that sometimes it actually will make things that aren't real, and it will fucking tell you things that aren't real, and you'll believe it if you don't kind of, like, treat it properly. And that's where that idea comes from. Oh, yeah, so in this film, in our script, this guy Matt, when Nigel and I were, like, discussing it, we were, like, getting way into this character. He was actually – Nigel, he had so much more to say about it than I did, but we came to the idea that this is the last moment before he's about to commit suicide. This is the day he's about to kill himself.
Hey, Nigel, the actor who played him.
Who played
was,
him.
Was he read that into it? He brought that to it? Or
yeah,
did,
he, well, we kind of came to that. We were like,
he's like, this guy, this is a day that this guy
is the
guy
day, yeah, this guy's on the fucking edge. This is just about it, you know? Right. There's nothing, you know, obviously his surroundings aren't doing this to him, because his surroundings are fine. Yeah. He sits in a little bit of traffic and he has no cash, but he's fine. But there's something he's about to go there, you know? He's going.
Interesting.
He's going
interesting.
There,
I mean,
you know?
I definitely didn't get that out of it, but I can totally see what he's doing, because one of the things that I really get off on in the film is when Lucifer in the back seat finally, instead of just shadowing him, mm-hmm. confronts him in the car, his lack of surprise.
Yeah, oh yeah, because he's been listening to him, he's been kind of hearing him all day, but now, and so that idea is that, like, if there was no intervention, he was gonna drive off, harm himself, or drive off a cliff, or do something. You know, there was divine intervention in the film, and that's why he turned it around partially. But he's been followed, and that's and it went
how
back
lucky
to,
are you? Well, it's funny because to have an actor who's so good and gets into it like that with you.
Yeah.
That's pretty... Was he just casting? Did you just put out a
casting? No, Nigel was my... Oh, so this is a long, funny story. We... the first person who was supposed to play that role was the guy that I developed the story with, and he dropped out in November of 2017, so we had no lead actor for 3 months. And then I went on Craigslist and found a dude. He'll probably never listen to this, but hopefully he does. And actually, hopefully he does, because he tried to hijack the script, and he read it, got back to me and said, oh, this is so funny. This is wonderful. And I met up with him, and he had the role. And then about a week before we were about to start, he wanted to start rewriting it.
Yeah.
And
not just his dialogue.
Oh, like, yeah. It wasn't funny anymore. I'm like, but you told me it was funny. He's like, yeah, it's just not working. I'm like, but I thought it was working. He's like, oh, it's almost there. He actually hit me with, oh, I have a friend over at Fox, and she said she's going to go through it with me, and then we'll bring
him
back.
Just a major bullshit artist.
Yeah, which I'm like I don't know if I'm like easily duped, but I'm like insecure about a lot of stuff, but I'm not insecure about my writing because I think it's the fucking best. And I'm not saying that like I'm better than anybody else. I think it's I know it's really, really good. So I'm like, well, your friend over at Fox, do they have anything I can read? And he's like, no. I'm like, well, she's not fucking reading my screenplay. How's that? Yeah, you know, I don't care who she is or where she works. She's not reading this unless I can read something that she's written. And if I don't like what she's written, she's not going through my shit.
You're directing. You wrote. You're producing.
Yeah.
You're making this film. If an actor wants to adjust their own lines, I'm sure you're pretty open to that.
I absolutely
am. But when someone wants to sit down and rewrite your...
His stuff wasn't...
Why doesn't he pay for the film then? Why didn't he put up the budget if he wants to rewrite it?
Because he was like, I checked you out on Google. I couldn't find you. You're not... no one even knows who you are. He's
so
like, this thing's going to fail. Yeah, this is going to fail if you don't listen to me.
What's failure for a short? Explain to me what fucking failure is.
Yeah, I got that
That's
whole
bullshit.
Thing. And I was like, okay, all right, I guess.
So you fired him on the spot? Or?
No, I was like, okay, I'll get back to you. And then I wrote him an email. I said, I think I'm all set. I don't need you anymore. And this is like 7 days before we're about to start, 9 days or something before about to start shooting. And he actually got back to me and apologized and said, I'll be there. And I said, nope, we don't need you. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
so who's the fucking dickhead? You know, you said that you thought that I was a loser. You just got fired off of a Craigslist gig, dude. But anyway, so I was friends with Nigel totally outside.
He was just a friend of yours.
Or independent of anything that had to do with creativity.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking to him. I didn't even know he was an actor. And he told me he was an actor. I'm like, oh, dude, I wrote this screenplay that we're about to shoot next week. He's like, oh, I'd love to check it out. And then I was meeting up with him on the Friday before we started to – if we shot Friday, March 10th? Saturday, March 10th. Friday, March 9th was the first – oh, Saturday, March 10th, 2018 was the first day of shooting. Friday, March 9th, I think, was our last rehearsal. And I think it was the week before that, which would make it March 2nd. I had Camille, who was in the movie, coming over to rehearse, and I needed somebody to step in for this character. And I told Nigel, I'm like, I was meeting up with him that day, totally outside or independent of anything that had to do with film or cinema. I said, I have somebody coming over today to read through these lines. I'm like, do you mind standing in while I try to find somebody? And he's like, oh, dude, I'd love to. He's like, I love the script, by the way. It's awesome. You know, he's like, he said he thought it was funny. He thought it was cool. And he came over and he just started, you know, prowling around the house like a fucking jaguar, and just got way into the role. And I felt like we had like Liam Neeson in the house. It was so I'm watching the both of them, and I'm like, wow. And I'm laughing.
Yeah, they have really good chemistry on screen.
No, they like totally got into it and they totally enjoyed it. It was so good.
I mean, the funny thing is, if you had told me I was friends with Nigel and I wrote the script with him in mind, I would believe that story.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's so perfect for that role.
Mm.
What he brings to it.
Whatever he brought to it was perfect.
Yeah.
He's like, and that's the reason, and I'm not going to, this is all conjecture here, but if the other kid who was trying to hijack the script actually did what was written in the script and what we wanted him to do, it would have been like an exploitation film about himself. And I think, which is the reason why he kind of did what he did. And, but Nigel is not like that. And he's actually like a really sweet, nice guy and totally not like the person in this, in the movie, and he just became that person. He went there. It was so cool.
Excellent. He acted.
Yeah. He interacted with the material, and then that's what he came out with. You know, it was really cool.
I think he did great. Well, so that Yeah, well, actually, it's funny because we jumped right into production.
Okay.
But then you talked about rehearsal and when you shot and this and that. So mm-hmm. you cast Camille first. And,
Camille was the...
And then Nigel, you casted last.
Nigel was the absolute last person to come on board. Dwight was the first person on board who actually made it into the production. Dwight, who played the dude in the green gown.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you had his dad play...
Yes,
play God.
Yeah. His dad played Dion. And Norman played that's who was Norman, and Dwight played Nixon.
Yeah,
and they were early in the script, and Dwight was the first guy that I was like, I kind of wrote this for you, and because he was the only actor I really like hung out with on a personal level.
Oh yeah,
and I was like, and I knew he'd be good, and it was a really difficult role, and he did it. He did a really good job. But so he was on board from November of 2017. Dwight was
excellent.
And then we found Camille on Craigslist, which still works. I'm sure everybody says that. But, yeah, and then the kid who shot at Manny, I found him on Craigslist. And, yes.
The kid who...
cinematographer.
Manny. Oh, who shot it. Right. Yep. I was thinking in actor terms. I'm like, wait, I don't remember kids shooting anyone. And I just watched it this morning.
Yeah, Manny I found on Craigslist. Yes.
And then, smooth shoot, good shoot. Everything felt good?
Yeah, everything was relatively easy, yes. We
You did it that John Sayles style, you kind of guerrilla'd it,
we went
ahead and just went around town and shot it?
Yep, some of the stuff, and then we fell into a really, we were very fortunate with a location in Long Beach for the juice bar after trying 20 or 30 juice bars in L.A. and Hollywood, and they all... acted as if we were in L.A. and Hollywood.
Yeah.
And
now all of a sudden they're saying, we need this much money.
Either this much money, just straight up didn't even get back to me, or just were rude. Yeah. Just, one guy was like, well, I don't know you. I'm like, yeah, I know, but I'm just asking you if we can shoot there, But
you go 45 minutes south and you
called
get nice.
One juice bar in Long Beach, and I was like, do you mind if we shoot a movie there? And she's like, yeah, sure, that's fine. And then we went down and met them, and the guy that owned it, his name was Raj, and he took us... We met him at the old place, and he took us to the new place, which was totally like an L.A. Silver Lake juice bar. It was fucking amazing. And we shot there. And then we had friends who had a stall also in Long Beach at a warehouse. And we used that we turned it into a yoga studio and a juice bar. And then we eat vegan food up at Organics in Eagle Rock. We were eating there a lot, and we just randomly asked him, and he was a... very, very gracious and kind, and let us shoot there for a very reasonable price. And where else? And then we shot at our home. We shot on the street, and all that was, kind of without permit or permission. Shot in the parking lot of Organics.
So totally your home. Permission. The set, obviously their home was yours.
Mm-hmm.
Cool artwork and stuff.
You oh, cool. Have, thank you, guys, you. Yes. Yeah.
Is that just how your place always is?
Yeah.
So you didn't even have to hire an art director.
No, we don't hire art directors.
It just happens you and your wife have really cool taste.
We always have very good taste, I think. Yeah, no, we don't have art directors, hair and makeup, or costume. We don't really do that stuff. Not yet. That's the way it is. Yeah. Yeah, actually, we did the film we just shot, one of the woman who was, the young woman who was going to be in it, she came over and she's like, are you Mexican? I'm like, no. And she's like, why do you have all this?
Did she know your name's Patrick Connolly?
She's like, why do you have all this art in here? And I'm like, oh, yeah. My wife likes, Catholic Christian imagery and Mexican folk art. And she's Filipino, and I'm Irish. But we just kind of like...
The Philippines was a Spanish colony, right?
Yeah, they were a Spanish colony. Spanish, yeah, I guess you could trace it to that. But yeah, totally...
We just like it.
Yeah, we just like it. And we like the way it looks, and it's just, it's cool and bizarre. And yeah, so that was the art in the house, yes.
And it's funny, because it carries something off about the couple in the film. Like, I think it adds to their characters to see their home and sort of see it's a cool pad.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that was the idea. I mean? Yeah, it's like a cool L.A. pad. They're a cool L.A. couple.
Yeah, I think it added authenticity for sure.
Nice, cool. Yeah, that's just the way it was. That was the whole John Cassavetes thing. It's another filmmaker that I was like, am still obsessed with, who most of his films are all shot in his home.
Yeah.
With his wife.
Yeah.
Funded by
him.
Yeah, and his friends funded by him. No permits, no permission, just everything, is done by him. But so we just, that's when I was like, oh, you can just keep using your house and using every room and every inch of your home to make a film.
Totally.
Yeah. Totally. And So we shot, the shooting was relatively easy. We shot it pretty much, without permits, without permission, except for where the places where people,
which again is totally appropriate. It's funny because as I watch it, I knew, you finished with some punk rock, right? There's punk rock over the end credits or...
Yeah, the gun club. Feels
punky. But it sort of has a punk rock vibe.
It's called cowpunk, yes.
Cowpunk,
okay. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It's the way you did it. Like, it has sort of that independent punk rock kind of...
Yeah. That was the gun club. That's not going to be in the cut.
That's what's pulled. That's what you had to pull.
Yeah, we may have gone
it. Pulling music is smart.
I know. No, we may have gone it. I spoken to Jeffrey Lee Pierce, was the lead singer and the main songwriter of the gun club. He passed away in 1995, and I reached out to his sister and got their information, but I never went through with licensing their music. But someday I will. But yeah, they're totally fucking. They're like the coolest band out of LA. The gun club, so cool. So cool. Yeah, they apparently started that cut. They were like Nirvana. He was too much of a sissy for punk, and he was like too much of a like rough, rugged dude for pop, and he kind of just somehow met it in the middle, and he kind of got obsessed with the Pixies, who like didn't have any interest in like looking tough or acting tough, but they also just couldn't conform to mainstream.
Yeah, they couldn't. Yeah. Yeah. And one mainstreamish album was what all the record company could squeeze out of them.
Yeah. And they kind of just found this happy medium. I don't know if it was happy, but they found a medium in between the two, and it's very cool. And the Gun Club were kind of like that. They weren't punk. They were part of the punk scene, and they weren't punk, and they weren't like hair metal. He was way into the blues and way into country, and he was also into punk, and he started fusing them, and apparently it wasn't very popular at the time, but that's still some of the best shit I've ever heard. So fucking cool.
All my favorite bands aren't that popular, but
yeah.
But then, I just read the Beastie Boys book. And they name checked bands like Minutemen and Black Flag and stuff, like the L.A. bands that were never that huge.
Yeah.
And, they were like, when we first saw them, they were in regular clothes, and we realized, oh, wow, it was rebellious not to try to have a punk look.
Yeah.
Don't want to distract from
okay, yeah.
I have a hunch you and I could talk about music for a while.
Yeah.
We should go back to your film.
I could talk about music, yes, but... we actually...
So good shoot, and then you edited it?
I edited it, yes.
At home, or...?
Back east, where I was staying at Mar... Well, actually, we wrapped on shooting the March 18th, 2018, and so I think I started editing on March 19th, 2018, which I...
Right, were you chomping to the bit? It was just a really good experience.
I was fucking dying to start editing. Yeah, I was already... I didn't do that in this past shoot. It took me about 2 or 3 weeks to even start to look at it. I was horrified. But with this, for some reason, I think I was already going through the footage the week in between two shoots of the...
So you shot two weekends?
We shot 2 weekends, yeah. Yeah, 12 p.m. and on. Yeah, no morning shoots. Yeah, no weekend.
Let everyone sleep in. People do that Friday night.
I don't like being anywhere in the morning, so hopefully nobody else does either. I'd rather be... Anyway, yeah, so we shot, 12 or 1 till 9 or 10 at night. And I was looking at the footage in between the 2 weekends, and then by the time we wrapped on that Sunday night, the next day I just started editing, and I edited from March 18th up until April, probably the end of April, early May, in my house in L.A., and then I went back east to work down the waterfront where I'm a longshoreman, and I'd stay at my father's house in Braintree. And it's not a big house, but it's just he and my mother and my Uncle John, and me for 5 months out of the year. So they got a pretty decent sized house with a downstairs with a finished cellar, whatever you want to call it. And I just set up a table down there with the two Bose speakers and started editing more down there. Yes.
Cool.
And that's why I'd be at work. And I'm doing it this year too. I'd work and I'd have time off of work. I'd fly back to the house. I'd edit for two, three, four hours. Then I'd go back to work, and that's how I edit.
You did some cool stuff in editing. I noticed watching this time, instead of, I think you were probably problem solving through it, but you did some cool times where you did a dissolve, where you would dissolve his face over hers, and that I could tell that was your way of getting
training
through.
I was something. Actually getting somebody's eye away from whatever the problem was.
Looking in the
was.
Camera or...
Yeah, no, like I was training the audience's eye away from the problem.
Oh, gotcha.
It was like a juggling...
I watched that and I'm like, that's a creative solution.
Thank you so much. That's such a nice compliment. Thank you so much. Yeah, there was a couple of things that was just problems where I couldn't... I color corrected it too. Mm-hmm. And there was a couple of shots where I just couldn't get it right for some reason because I don't know how to color. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. I do know how to color correct. I color corrected the movie. But I'm not that good at it, nor have I mastered it. So I couldn't quite figure out how to why it kept like popping a certain color in one shot. So that's when I used a dissolve and put her face over here and then his face over here.
Yeah.
And then it went, and then it cut away from his face being there. But I still had the audio from that one single frame and then the one single shot. And then it cut back to where the color was matched two shots before that, you know?
Well, I liked it. And anyway, it worked for me.
Thank
it
you was, so it much. Really it's cool. So cool. Yeah,
it's,
yeah, yeah.
It's cool.
And I can actually talk about the editing too.
Yeah, sure.
Very quickly. Cause I got ideas like that. So just like when I went and saw Brother from Another Planet, I was like, it just kind of like blew my mind open and changed the way I kind of looked at things. In April of 2018, when I was about a month into editing The Craven Ritual, they had the Turner Classic Movies Film Fest in Hollywood, where they screen at like the Egyptian and the Chinese Theater and a couple other theaters right there. And I went and saw wasn't in a double bill. They were across the street from each other. One was at 4 in the afternoon, and the other one was at 7 in the afternoon. I went and saw Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with Melvin Van Peebles and Mario in person.
Classic one.
And then across the street was Point Blank was playing at 7 p.m. Both were on film, and they were like, and I actually told a friend of mine who was a total film major, you know, got his master's in film and he works in film, that I saw those two back to back. He's like, dude, that's like, those are like two of the biggest editing feats in the history of cinema. But I went and saw Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. And I learned a couple of things, and one of them was that you can literally do whatever you want when you make a movie. No, there you can fucking, and I didn't even realize that until I saw this movie. I walked out of there literally like I felt like I was using about like 20. I wrote this down in an Instagram thing. I felt like I was using about 20% of my creative brain capacity before I saw that movie. And then I saw that movie and I'm like, that guy was using fucking 99% of his brain capacity.
Right. In that edit, you can mix anything.
You can do anything you want.
Pull, push.
You anything.
Break timelines.
Fade a fucking face over a face. You can make it totally red. You can make it. You can do whatever you want. And that's when I was like, oh, I can do anything because I'm editing this movie and it's mine, you know? And so that's when I was like, I started. And I didn't experiment as much as I even would have liked to. But that's where like any sort of like editing tricks or things I used was after watching that movie. Because I like totally got the confidence to be like, oh, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, because you do that in the car too, right? Where there's a dissolve or two.
There's a dissolve, and there's like a I don't even know what it's called, but it like.
But I think it's when he's having his spiritual.
Yeah, it flips the color inside out and stuff. It makes it go all red and shit. You know, like you can just because I was after watching that movie, I basically gave me permission.
Oh yeah, you do that at the very end, right? When we're looking at Lucifer,
I do. Yeah,
and he does
the
smile. Yeah, he does that.
And it's like it's a quick frame to like a blown out green. It's like all green or something. Yeah. That was after watching that movie. I was like, Melvin Van Peebles gave me permission to do that while I was editing my film, you know?
Permission, inspiration?
It was permission, inspiration, yes. Yeah, totally.
Awesome. Fantastic that you got to see that. You saw that while you were editing?
In the middle of the editing.
In the middle of the edit. Wow, what a great thing.
Yeah, and I didn't know what direction to go to or where I was going to go. And after seeing that, I'm like, oh, that's how to solve that. Do whatever the fuck you want, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's not, I need reshoots. It's not, I didn't get what I needed. Yes. It's that I can take what I've got. And I can manipulate it. It's clay.
I can manipulate, exactly.
Yeah.
That's what he did when he edited that film. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
That's very cool. And of all the cool things to live now in the day of digital editing where in Van Peebles' time, like you were physically cutting film.
Using
a
little guillotine.
Way more limiting. Whereas now
you can do anything. Yeah. And there's all these little effects you can use. And
on a computer, on an affordable computer, you can do this.
I do it on a little laptop. Yeah. I edit it on a laptop and I hook up a couple of speakers to it. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I have a mouse, you know, and it's just totally cool. Yeah. After I finished it, I sought out, and it's, maybe it's hard for people. It wasn't difficult for me. I just found people who were into film. And I asked them to watch my movie, you know, and I got like a lot of really cool feedback.
Like friends or?
Friends,
or
yes. Friends and acquaintances and
right,
shit.
Right, so you fanned it out.
And I basically
did your own focus group in a way?
Kind of, yeah. And I have them sit down and like one of my buddy Adam G, he went through and he lopped off like 4 minutes for me. He didn't do it. He was suggested all these cuts that you could make, you know, and it actually worked and it like made it like tighter and cleaner and and the pacing like smoother. It was you know, and it was really helpful. You know, and then
a second pair of eyes is always great.
It was. My buddy Pablo watched it and he was like, "Dude, this is like a fucking Spike Lee joint." And I was like, "Wow, thank you." And that's not that I'm not trying to downplay anything Spike's done, but he was like, "Oh, this reminds me of a Spike Lee movie."
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about the earlier days, obviously.
Yeah. That's I'm also very inspired by that stuff. But Pablo's the one that showed me how to color correct. Mm-hmm. You know, and So the editing process went quite well, and then once I had finished editing, George, the sound guy, referred me to a sound mixer who mixed the sound and cleaned it all up, and that was really cool too.
Yeah, your sound is good.
Thank you. Yeah, they did a very good job. Yes.
Yeah, there's never a point where, you know, a lot of indie films, you're like, wait a minute, I missed a line.
Yours
is clear. Good dialogue.
Yeah, because he mic'd them for a dialogue, you know.
So you got good production audio.
Oh, totally. I got very good production audio. Yeah, and the guy that mixed it did a very good job too. But yeah, it's a dialogue piece, so it was very, very important that he got all the dialogue, you know. And
Yeah, although you're calling it a dialogue piece, but you tell a lot visually too.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool. So? Thank you. I don't know. I shouldn't even say that I didn't plan to, but that wasn't the idea. No. If you read the script,
you threw your lead guy in fluorescent green spandex shorts
because he had them. They were green in the script, but Nigel's like, I got these spandex shorts that I have. Do you want to take?
That whole scene is full of witty dialogue. But still, the visual of him just, like, popping up in the doorway.
Yeah.
In the spandex.
And that was actually originally written. They were both naked.
Yeah.
And I'm, like, totally interested in this, like, unerotic nudity.
Yeah.
Which actually was done in Roma, the film we saw this past year. There's a character in it that's, like, just fully stock naked for, like, an entire 5-minute scene. And literally after, like, 15 seconds... You don't even recognize or care that the man's naked. It was really cool, and that was just before we wrote that. But I wanted to like just make it like two like a real couple who are just like totally not disgusted with each other, but just like we're all set with each other.
I mean, and when you're in a long term relationship, you can be naked together, and it's not about sex.
It's just like, you know, it always is for me,
but I'm like, whatever, I'm still like a teenage boy.
Well, that's what he was like in the thing.
Because she was just getting ready. That kind of won me over in a way, because I am him. I've had that conversation where she's completely focused on something else, and I'm looking at her and going, you know?
Yeah.
And then she looks at me and goes,
grow up.
Really?
Yeah.
Seriously, right now? That's like 11th on my list.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what it was. She was
such a real moment.
Yeah, she was like very mature about it, and he was just totally immature about it, and he just wanted to sneak one in before he goes to his class, you know?
Yeah.
And
so then you, it's less than a year later, and you've got a feature already.
Yeah, so we were...
You're shooting, or you shot?
We shot.
So
over the summer of 2018, while I was editing The Creeping Ritual, I was having ideas for the next film that we wanted to make, and I wanted to make a feature length this time, and it's kind of in the same vein of what we did. It's about meditation, about people, crazy people that go to meditation group, you know.
Oh, cool.
That's the whole, that's pretty much what the whole film,
same kind of vibe of like walks the line between comedy at times and drama at times.
Hopefully, but it's a little more dramatic. I didn't think that The Creeping Ritual had any drama to it. I just thought it was just pure comedy to me,
very funny.
Yeah, I just looked at it as at least everything that everybody was doing in it, whether they were serious or not, was making me laugh while we were making it. The feature one we did wasn't really like that. There was some real drama in it, some real heavier stuff, you know, which I always go back to it for some reason.
You wrote it during the edit of Creeping Ritual?
While I was editing, I wrote, like, I mapped out a story, and then I started writing the screenplay the week I got back in November, and then Nigel, actually, who's the lead actor in the feature, came on, and he co-wrote the screenplay with me.
Oh,
and
cool.
So we wrote the screenplay in about 2 months from November to January, and then I wrote 5 more drafts, and then we shot it in April 2019. And
wow.
I'm editing that right now.
3 months ago.
Yes, yep, and I just...
Like a 2-week shoot, 3 weeks, couple weeks?
It was nine days.
Weekend. 9 days.
So we shot over 4 weekends.
Wow.
3 weekends or 4 weekends, I forget.
Anyone else from Creeping Ritual besides Nigel?
Dwight's in it. Dwight's got a pretty big role in it as a veteran, a military veteran seeking out meditation, and Camille's the lead actress.
Oh, excellent.
Who plays, the story's based around her. She plays an adult film actress conflicted about her work, is directed to meditation to reconcile with her inner conflict about her work because she is a recovering Catholic. And at the group, she meets a strange group of meditators and is, you know, kind of intrigued by the guru who's also troubled, played by Nigel. He plays a meditation guru.
I could see that.
Yeah, he did. Oh, everybody did. That's quite an experience we had with that one, too. That one was fucking crazy. That one scared me. The creeping ritual, I wasn't as scared, or I was like, I guess I got nervous and stuff, but it wasn't. We shot The Creeping Ritual, which is a 19-minute film. And one of the biggest things I learned making it is, like, we spent X amount of dollars on this. And I'm like, I could have done so much more. Now, I didn't spend a lot of money on it, but I'm like, the amount of money that we spent on this, we could have stretched out so much more. I'm like, I can just make a feature-length film, and it's not going to be four times the price of what a 19-minute film is.
Right.
An 80-minute film is not four times the price of a 19-minute film.
Right, controlling locations and
you just get more out of every day, or you can make it so that you get more out of every day and kind of pay the same price. You know what I mean? But here's a thing I learned, or whatever you want to call it, a rule I learned: the stress and the worry is for maybe even more, four times the length.
Right, so you're 10 times more stressed.
I was fucking 10 times more stressed and more frightened and anxiety and horrified.
Because it's just a bigger beast.
It was just, and just the concept of making a feature-length film really got, like, and my ego got wrapped up in it, too, before we shot it. I was just, like, not in a bad way. I'm probably being a little hard on myself, but, like, like, it means something.
What would you call her character? Reformed Catholic or recovering Catholic?
She's a recovering Catholic. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Are you too? Also, I was.
I don't have any hatred towards it. Yeah. I just, I'm all set.
Hard on yourself is
Catholic. Oh, it's a very Catholic thing. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's.
That's all about being hard.
Yeah. I'm 37. I can still beat myself up. That's what I get out of going to church and CCD for.
I'm 50. I can beat myself up. I can be like, damn it.
Yeah.
Well, at this age, I really should have my shit together.
I should have my shit together, yeah.
I shouldn't have gotten mad, but, I just got really...
I was self-absorbed most of the thing, but, like, getting all that stuff together, and, like, we had 29 people that needed to be on board for the feature length, as opposed to how many we needed. Cast and crew was 29 people.
29.
It was a lot.
But it was a good group again, and you got the feeling that...
Most of the same people. Yeah, we're trying to... I read somewhere Paul Thomas Anderson talking about how he, like, you know, built or designed his own, like, repertory theater with his first three films.
He really did.
Yeah, it was, like, all the same people, and it was kind of, like, a lot of the same crew. We're trying to do the same thing and just kind of...
Honestly, even people like James Cameron...
Yeah.
You know, they have their people.
They have their people,
It really is a community.
Yeah, you just build a community of people you like working with, and, like, we find people that we like working with that like doing what we're doing, and we kind of keep it
going. Yeah, and you kind of lucked out because... You know, I mean, everything in life takes luck, but, like, you know, you had a friend like Nigel who ends up being perfect in the film.
Yeah.
And bringing more to it than you would even ask the original guy.
I couldn't even squeeze that out of somebody if I wanted to. Yeah. He brought that himself.
Yeah, and he happened to be a friend. That's like, you know, that's higher powers at work.
Yeah. No, it was. It was beyond my control. Absolutely.
And whose idea was the meditation? Your original concept was mine. Do you meditate or anything?
I do meditate, yeah. Twice a day for 20 minutes a day.
Oh, man. Yeah. I'm one of those people who have always been interested.
Yeah.
I finally started a little bit.
Oh, yeah, cool.
Well,
good for you.
Well, I finally started doing yoga a little bit. And then last position, it says, just do this for 5 minutes.
Yeah,
this little thing I have.
Yep.
So 5 minutes of, like, silence, I'm like, wow, it's going to be a while. And it's, like, over before I can
know it. Yeah, it goes by pretty fast. Yeah. There's a lot of preconceived notions about meditation, too. And one of them is that it makes you serene, which is a fucking lie. Another one that makes you happy. In my opinion, my experience, not my opinion, a lie, but it does certain things to you. It actually rewires your brain, so you can't fall into, like, the same obsessive, whatever you want to call it.
Like loop?
Obsessive, like, compulsive loop. Yeah. You can't, they're actually mutually exclusive.
Now I'm just talking about meditation, but during the meditation, you're 20 minutes twice a day. Are you focusing on nothing, or are you just letting your mind go wherever it goes?
I have a what's it called?
Are you listening to a?
No, I have a I can't believe I can't think of the word right now. A chant, that a one mantra? Word, a mantra. I have a mantra, and I usually it comes through my head, but most of the time I just have a song that goes through my head, and then thoughts go through my head, but they come and go.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no such thing as blank. Yeah, yeah, you just have to let it. So there's no blankness.
Yeah, I was told. I heard somewhere. I heard on, I think, Mark Maron's What the Fuck podcast. He was talking to somebody.
Yeah, he hates meditation.
But like, he's fascinated by it. Yeah. Just like me. And he was like, someone said, no, of course, there's stuff on your mind the whole time. Like, you can't empty. There's no such thing as having an empty mind.
There's no such thing as it. My mind races the whole time.
Yeah.
But
you give yourself 20 minutes to do that.
Yeah, I used to give weight to shit that's not, wasn't real, like the person in the creeping ritual. And it would like, it actually would create narratives that would actually like eat me up, and I could let it go on sometimes for days, and it would turn into months, and it could turn into years. It's obsessive compulsive thinking. I used to give more weight to that than the fact that like I was coming over to Jeff's Howard's house today to do a podcast. But actually, and that's actually real, and the narrative in my head is not real, but I would give the narrative in my head more weight than what I was actually doing. And like when you meditate, it kind of balances them out, and you can't give lies in your head the weight that you used to give to them. That's what that's what the new film is kind of a lot of it is about.
I was going to say, the fact that you do meditate gives me an inkling that like the film will come from a really cool place.
Yeah, because, hopefully, yeah.
Because it's not, you know, it's, I could see a meditation film sort of being insincere, because there's a lot of people like deal with it insincerely, I think. So you're obviously going to deal with it from a very real perspective.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a very, very realistic film. Yeah. I was inspired by a lot of people.
You guys going to finish in time for November?
I don't know.
Probably
I
just not. It takes a long time.
I finished our first rough cut.
Features.
The first rough cut's done, 1 hour and 39 minutes, but I don't know if it'll be done by November.
That would have been pretty miraculous for someone to have a short at Sherman Oaks Film Festival in November 2018 and be back with a completed feature within a year. That's a pretty big ask.
Yeah. No, I don't know. Maybe we'll see. I'll see how it goes. It's going very steady and very well, you know, and it's
happy.
Moving. Yeah, very happy. Yeah.
And that was about an hour and whatever, hour and 15 minutes of my almost 2 hour talk with Patrick. I got to tell you, Patrick Connolly is a great guy, great filmmaker. I hope you've already seen The Creeping Ritual, and if you haven't, again, go to Amazon Prime Video and check out Discovery Indie Films Season 2, Episode 9. I think it's 9. I should have checked. Or, of course, you can go to discoveryindiefilm.com and find out where to see it there. But I want to give a sincere thanks to Patrick for coming by and having such a great conversation with me about him and his filmmaking history and his excellent film, The Creeping Ritual. And now we've come to the time that I do a little housekeeping. DiscoveryIndieFilm.com, I already mentioned, that's for this podcast and the Amazon Prime TV series. If you're into social media, at DIFWins is Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Everything Discovery Indie Film is right there, at DIFWins. And the Sherman Oaks Film Festival comes up every November. We're going to have great films this November, 21st to 24th. The schedule is nearly set. And Film Invasion Los Angeles comes up every June. And that's a great film festival, so that one's accepting entries. And if you want to look either of those up, Sherman Oaks Film Festival is shermanoaksff.com. And Film Invasion Los Angeles is filminvasionla.com. I think that's all I need to say. Thanks for listening.